including a child, and left several others injured. The situation in southern city of Rafah has also deteriorated, with intensified airstrikes and artillery shelling killing at least five people. Meanwhile, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Israel Katz, announced plans to expand the military's ground operations in Gaza, aiming to seize large areas to be added to the so-called buffer zones in the Strip. Since mid-March, Israel's renewed aggression has killed over 1,000 Palestinians. The overall death toll from the genocide in Gaza has reached nearly 50,400. Well, for more updates on the situation in Gaza, we're now joined by Ada Ibrahim, who's with us from Gaza City, to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments in Gaza. Ada, what do you have to share with us?
Since the dawn of this morning, at least 21 Palestinians have been killed in different airstrikes on different parts of the Gaza, of the city of Gaza, and on the southern districts of Khan Yunis and Rafah. The most prominent of these airstrikes was the one that caused a massacre against the family, Abd al-Bari family, in the center of Khan Yunis, that killed at least 11 of the same family. They were in their residential home when the Israeli airstrike hit the building. That caused a lot of damage and many injuries. Another was here on the southern and the eastern parts of the Gaza City. As you know here, or may you notice that the sounds of the drones above me, the drones and the Israeli warplanes continue hovering at very low altitude, shooting live ammunition towards the southern and the eastern parts of the city of Gaza. Also, the situation in Rafah remains very tense and even deteriorates even more after more than or nearly 10 days of complete siege on the city. The Israeli army declared the intention of expanding the ground operation there after issuing an evacuation order to the whole of the city of Rafah. And after that, here in the north, or also in the northern parts of the city of Gaza, in Beit Hanun and in Beit Lahia, the Israeli army issued evacuation orders yesterday to the whole area of Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia. That caused a lot of a catastrophe to the people there. As you know, or as you remember, these people living in these areas of Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun, a few weeks ago, were returning to the rubble of their homes, and now they are forced to live under the fire of the Israeli occupation, warplanes and shells of the tanks.
All right, thanks a lot. Ada Ibrahim joining us from Gaza City. The United Nations has rejected Israel's claim that there are sufficient food supplies in the besieged Gaza Strip. This after the World Food Program reported the closure of all its bakeries across the territory. The world body's reaction followed the regime's claim that despite the ban on aid entry to Gaza, there is enough food for a long period of time. UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric dismissed Israel's allegation as ridiculous, adding that UN supplies in Gaza are almost finished. He emphasized that the World Food Program has closed its bakeries due to lack of flour and fuel. Meanwhile, head of the Gaza Bakery Association was quoted by local media as saying that all bakeries in Gaza have indefinitely ceased their operations due to a critical shortage of flour and fuel. The official described the current situation as an ongoing hunger war. Since March 2nd, Israel has not allowed any aid to be delivered to Gaza, saying the ban will continue until Hamas releases all remaining captives.
The Gaza Strip is facing a severe humanitarian crisis as Israeli blockade, now exceeding a month, continues to prevent the entry of essential aid, including food, fuel, and medical supplies.
The Gaza Strip is going through the most dire circumstances ever. The famine is back again, even more severely, as 25 bakeries stop completely. This current crisis is unprecedented, as this is the longest time span of closure of the Gaza crossings by the Israeli regime. This in turn has caused the shortage of flour and fuel needed for the bakeries to operate.
The United Nations World Food Program reported that all bakeries in Gaza have ceased operations due to the acute shortages of flour and fuel. The WFP emphasized that bread, often the only accessible food for many families, is becoming unattainable, warning that famine is a serious risk looming for the Gazan population.
All the bakeries closed today because of the continuing closure of crossings. All what was stored in our warehouses by the WFP have been consumed completely. So here we are now, without any ingredients there is no way we can work. We used to consume 250 to 300 tons of flour daily, which was less than the actual amount needed for the population. Now there is no choice for us.
The dire humanitarian crisis is further exacerbated by the continuous Israeli military aggression that not only claims the lives of thousands, but also makes survival for 2.2 million Gazans a struggle.
As the blockade endures, the people of Gaza continue to face an increasingly desperate struggle for survival, with starvation looming as a significant threat besides the continuous Israeli aggressive attacks. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Moving on, Iran has strongly condemned Israel's continued aggression against Lebanon, including Tuesday's deadly airstrike, which killed many civilians, including a Hezbollah official and his son. The foreign ministry spokesman said the regime has breached the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon over 2,000 times and violated the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ismail Baroui described Israel's aggression as a blatant violation of international law and human rights. He said the inaction of the ceasefire guarantors in the face of Israel's rogue behavior proves their promises' lack of any credibility. He also slammed the silence of international organizations, especially the UN Security Council, on Israel's heinous crimes in Lebanon and the occupied Palestine. Baroui said the U.S. and its Western allies are complicit in Israel's crimes, calling on regional countries to take more serious action to oppose the regime's expansionist policy. We earlier talked to political analyst Bruno Bicchini to get his insight on Israel's constant violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon. Let's take a listen.
The guarantors of the ceasefire, they kind of act as hypocrites because Israel must be punished. If they violate the ceasefire, they would have to receive, for example, blockade and sanctions with the SWIFT system and all of the financial system controlled by the guarantors. As long as U.S. does not put pressure on Israel, and will never do this, we understand that the Arab nation and the Muslim countries, they must defend themselves. I have even another thing to say. I'm very disappointed, but it's not a surprise, with the so-called Lebanese army and Lebanese armed forces, because I said this in this channel, on this television. As far as the Lebanese forces, they are down south, and they will have the duty to protect the civilians and to expose the invaders. As long as they don't fight against the Zionist army, they force Hezbollah to get into the conflict again. And that's exactly what's happening now. Tel Aviv understands that every target is legitimate if they allow them to be a Hezbollah base or a Lebanese resistance base. And during this time, the Lebanese forces, they do almost nothing. This is the same old situation in Lebanon. And the guarantors, as long as they don't punish Israel, what are they doing and what do they serve?
Well, on that note, Israeli forces have intensified their violent operations in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, deploying a large number of infantry units. Israeli forces killed a 33-year-old Palestinian during a morning raid in the old city of Nablus. The regime's forces also demolished a Palestinian farm and several structures in the town of Abu Dis, east of Al-Quds. Correspondent Nara Hamed is joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank with more updates and details on that story.
Yes, well, in the area of Anata, the IOF just withdrawn from Anata to the east of occupied Al-Quds after demolishing a home for the family of Haydat in Anata and bulldozing an agricultural land and agricultural institutions inside Anata. This is not the first attack upon Anata and upon Palestinian lands and upon Palestinian homes, where the IOF is continuously making demolishing Palestinian homes and specifically to the area of occupied Al-Quds and to the provenance of occupied Al-Quds, where basically it's Smotrich, the Israeli minister, the Israeli far right minister, have announced that there will be many demolishing orders performed this year, as he called 2025 the year of demolishment for the Palestinians. Also in Ramallah, the occupation forces have ambushed a building in Ain Misbah and made searching inside the apartments and moving out the families from inside this building and making incursions towards the houses of these building. Over here also, if we are to stay in Ramallah and in the provenance of occupied Al-Quds, a Palestinian young man, a 33 years old Palestinian young man, who was shot in live ammunition on a Qalandia checkpoint to the north of occupied Al-Quds, reportedly by the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, that the young man was shot in both of his legs in live ammunition, and later he was hospitalized. He was hospitalized in Ramallah General Hospital. So the incursions and the attacks upon the Palestinian city, the apparition goes on. Here also the IOF continued their operations inside Jenin and Tulkarem. Local resources have indicated even more bulldozing for what is left from the infrastructure in Jenin refugee camp and around Jenin refugee camp. So the demolishing campaign has expanded towards Jenin city, not only limited to Jenin refugee camp. And in Tulkarem, many families were forcibly displaced from their homes, adding up to a total number of 65,000 displaced Palestinians. This is directly due to the military operation, the Iron Wall, that is going on in the northern part of the West Bank for more than 70 days. Now.
Thanks a lot, Nahal Hamed, joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh anti-U.S. operation, targeting an American aircraft carrier in the Red Sea for the third time in the past 24 hours.
In response to the American aggression against our country, the naval forces, rocket forces, and the air force of our armed forces have targeted hostile warships in the Red Sea, including the American aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman, using several cruise missiles and drones. The engagement is ongoing at the time of this statement, marking the third such operation in the past 24 hours. Our military operations against the American enemy will continue, targeting their warships in the declared operational zone with increasing intensity, God willing.
Saadi added that Yemen's operations against Israel will also continue by preventing navigation of the regime's vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas and targeting its military and vital facilities. He stressed that anti-Israel operations will go on until the regime's genocide against the oppressed Palestinian people in Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The United States has carried out fresh airstrikes on various areas across Yemen to make the Arab country stop its support for Palestinians in Gaza. In their latest aggression, American warplanes conducted 5 airstrikes on the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The United States also carried out 5 air raids on the Sa'ada governorate after an earlier strike on Hodeida. The strike on Hodeida governorate hit the water company in the city of Al-Mansouriyah, leaving 4 people dead and several others injured. Yemen's Hajja governorate was another target of U.S. airstrikes, where American warplanes hit the Washa district with 3 raids. Most of the U.S. attacks target civilian buildings in the Yemeni capital. Washington claims the attacks are meant to protect freedom of navigation in nearby waters. Yemen rejects the claim, saying its naval operations solely target Israel-linked ships in an attempt to stop the regime's genocide in Gaza. And Iran's foreign ministers dismiss U.S. President Donald Trump's latest threats about using military force to bomb the country's nuclear sites. Abbas Araghchi asserted that there is no such a thing as a military option, let alone a military solution, with regards to Iran's peaceful nuclear program. He noted that although the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran has been committed to the deal. The top diplomat said there is not one shred of proof that Iran has violated its commitment under the nuclear agreement. Araghchi said Iran has reaffirmed that under no circumstances it will ever seek, develop, or acquire nuclear weapons. He also cautioned against any U.S. adventurism, saying catastrophic failures in the region have cost prior U.S. administrations more than $7 trillion. Araghchi concluded by saying that diplomatic engagement has worked in the past and can still work. His remarks followed a phone call with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, during which he called on the UN Nuclear Agency to take a clear stance on threats made against Iran's nuclear sites. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A failure to act on its legal obligations deepens the UK government's complicity in the Zionist regime's violent oppression of the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, for decades, successive UK governments have held the position that Israel's settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Despite having this clear legal position, the perfidy and hypocrisy of the UK government is without end. The government has both a moral and a legal duty under international law to prohibit all UK investment and trade with a settlement enterprise of any regime that has transferred its own civilian population into the occupied territories, an activity constituting a grievous breach of the preemptory norms of international law. Since 1967, the Zionist regime has seized thousands of dunams of Palestinian land to establish its illegal settlements, part of a long-held strategy to ethnically cleanse Palestinians and hem them into tiny Bantustans. Israel's goal is to annex the West Bank with as few Palestinians on the land as possible. This long-held policy of maximum Jew minimum Palestinians is being implemented in real time, with 40,000 Palestinians recently having been forcibly displaced from Jenin and last year's erasure of at least 50 entire communities. In establishing illegal settlements, the Israeli regime has created facts on the ground to ensure that a Palestinian state is rendered impossible. Yet despite the UK government acknowledging that these activities threaten peace and the physical viability of a two-state solution, the British toothless government has failed to impose meaningful sanctions while continuing to allow the import and sale of illegal settlement goods. This runs counter to to the nation's duty under international law. It is a deliberate choice that has rendered the UK government complicit in Israel's criminality and violent systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. The government has avoided publishing a formal response to the July 2024 findings of the International Court of Justice, which deemed Israel's decades-long occupation to be unlawful and highlighted the global community's responsibility to act accordingly. The UK has a duty to not render aid or assistance to Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and to bring to an end serious breaches of preemptory norms of international law. In refusing to prohibit such activities, the UK regime stands in violation of its obligation to not recognize as legal the situation arising from Israel's unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territories. All of this is clearly a violation of the obligations and duties of the 30 states, which could result in the UK being held legally culpable in the Zionist regime's violations. In recent years, the UK government has been given multiple opportunities to impose a ban on the importation of goods from illegal Israeli settlements. But despite rhetorical condemnation, the only practical measures taken have been to exclude these goods from tariff and trade preferences, while advising UK businesses to bear in mind that Israel settlements are illegal under international law. Nothing of substance has been done to uphold the UK's obligations to isolate Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and bring an end to these serious breaches of international law, which, at the bare minimum, should entail a ban on purchases or investments in that enterprise. By allowing the continuation of economic activities, including charitable work with the Zionist regime's illegal settlement enterprise, through a refusal to implement a strict ban, the UK regime is effectively disregarding the ICJ's advice that third states must take steps to prevent trade or investment relations that assist in the maintenance of the illegal situation created by the Zionist regime in the occupied Palestinian territory. Rather outrageously, in a recent session of the Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee, Middle East Minister Hamish Falconer acknowledged that products from Israel's illegal settlements are sold in the UK and that it's up to individual businesses to decide whether to stock them. Turning this into an optional choice provides a convenient loophole that shifts the burden of action away from the government and onto individual business and trading entities themselves. This effectively greenlights such economic ties. Without further progress on the matter, including an immediate shift in policy to ban all economic activity involving illegal settlements, the British are complicit as a country in the violent oppression of Palestinians and the occupation of Palestinian land and failing to live up to their obligated duties under international law. The UK should immediately enact a full trade ban and prohibit any economic activities with the Zionist regime's illegal settlements. Should the government continue to evade its duties, then the dozens of MPs who last month issued a letter demanding such a ban must act to bring a private member's bill to this effect, similar to the legislation Ireland is considering. Their devolved assemblies and parliaments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland should also implement their own bans within their jurisdictions, and local authorities should take steps to implement ethical investment policies to ensure their assets and pension funds are not tied to any illegal settlement enterprises too. Without such a move, the government cannot continue claiming to oppose settlements. The UK government must be consistent in its application and upholding of international law, or else face severe legal consequences for continued their inaction. We may also soon see cases arise where Palestinians living in the UK rightfully take up legal action against businesses and companies that ignore the UK government's advice by continuing their economic activities with illegal settlements, a matter that should be seen as a clear warning to all.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now imagine enduring over 8 years of daily bombings and artillery attacks on your country, coupled with a crippling siege on your ports, denying the entry of basic supplies to your civilian population. The death, destruction, hunger, displacement, and disease that your people suffer. Now imagine that onslaught no sooner subsides that the same nightmare has just become someone else's fresh debacle. Such is the story of Yemen, a resilient people who resisted a Western-backed campaign behind the Saudis to subjugate Yemen can be enjoying peace today and working on rebuilding their war-torn nation, but instead, they have chosen to fight for their brethren in Palestine. Yemen's anti-Israel and anti-U.S. operations to bring an end to the genocide in and the siege of the Gaza Strip is a focus of our Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us is Mr. Saad, Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University in occupied Ramallah. And Mr. McNapier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess Professor Saad, Nimr, we'll start with you. Welcome, sir. Your initial thoughts, how justifiably so the people of Yemen today can say we are beat up, we are hungry, too tired to fight, yet they show nothing but will and fortitude when it comes to Palestine, and in fact have implored and lambasted other Arab and Muslim leaders for not doing their part in supporting Palestinians.
I think that maybe the only people who can feel with us quite well are the Yemenis, because they've been through that in the last, you know, for 8 years of a war, which was launched against them, supported by America, and they make them, you know, suffer a lot. And then they saw the same thing is happening to the Palestinian people, and especially the genocide war against the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And they felt the same feeling, you know, for the Palestinian. And no one stand with Yemen during that period. And they said, now we should stand by the Palestinians. And that's why they were, you know, out of lots of reasons, Yemenis are committed to help the Palestinians. And through the whole period of the war against Gaza, they were joining, and they joined, and they had an embargo on the Israeli shipments, closing their ports, and closing the Red Sea for sailing, or anyone who's serving Israel as well. And that makes them, you know, feel the same feeling as they felt during the war of 8 years of Saudi Arabia and Emirates, who launched it against the Houthis. Now they are doing the same to the Palestinian and helping the Palestinian when no one of the Arab countries had helped them during this war. And that's why they felt, I think that this is the main reason. And also their commitments as Arabs, as Muslims, as also humans who would help the Palestinian. For all these reasons, they were there to help the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Thank you, Professor Nimr. Mr. McNapier, welcome to the conversation, sir. Thank you for your patience. Just moments ago, less than an hour ago, we had breaking news here a series of 13 intense airstrikes by U.S. warplanes again have targeted the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, following earlier strikes that resulted in at least one dead and five wounded. Mick, obviously Yemen, at a considerable cost to itself, continues to stand militarily against the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian people in this three-week siege now on the entry of all aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. How do you assess Yemen saying that its stance here is a sense of duty and obligation to stand with the Palestinian people?
It's so clear. It's really good people versus bad people. It's if you were looking at the world from outer space, you would see the genocide taking place in a small place called Palestine, and silence and gloom elsewhere, and active support from some governments. But you would see Yemen. You would see that this was a place where vast numbers of people actually took a practical stand. We know that all over the world, great numbers of people in every country oppose what America is doing. Great majority of people in Britain oppose what America is doing. But we're unable to reach the stage where we can give practical support to the Palestinians facing a genocidal monstrosity. And the Yemenis have taken this action. As Saad Nimr points out, it's the fruit of experience. We're coming up, actually, I just saw, we're coming up to about 10 years anniversary. About 10 years ago, the Saudis commemorated or even celebrated the first stage of their attempts to subjugate Yemen. And in order to celebrate this the stage, Prince Walid bin Talal offered all 100 Saudi pilots who were dropping American bombs on Yemen and had been doing so for many years, he offered every single pilot a Bentley car. Now, the revulsion around the world was so great, I don't know if he actually delivered the cars, but it brought into sharp relief the disgusting nature of this extremely wealthy and powerful state, Saudi Arabia, trying to bomb the Yemenis into the ground and thinking 10 years ago that they had succeeded, reached the end of the first stage. So I think the Americans need to learn from this. The Americans have slaughtered people in country after country, it should be noted, quite successfully, in order to crush opposition and drown it in blood. But when they came to a particular country, Vietnam, they encountered a population which was determined to resist, a people, and with a leadership that was determined to resist. That's the situation in Yemen. It's a very different situation in many ways, but they meet a population who demonstrate in their millions every Friday in support of the challenge to Israel, in support of the challenge to the USA, which clearly enjoys mass support, and a leadership which really seems to be determined to pick up this challenge and come to the aid of the Palestinians. It's genocide. Regimes are silent. Many regimes are supporting the genocide, and the Yemenis are coming out practically in support. This will not be forgotten when the history books are written. And I think the Yemenis' approach from a tremendous history of resistance, but they also approach from a knowledge, they're sitting in a very strategic waterway. And they can, if they can absorb the punishment from the Americans, they can deliver a significant blow to the Western economy. And they've proven that already. If they hold their ground, then Trump, by the way, Trump was elected on a platform of ending foreign wars. And now he says that he'll bomb Yemen without any limit of time. This doesn't play well in America. But this is what Trump's trying to do. If the Yemenis can hold on, can continue to resist, there are many strong forces which suggest that they could be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Napier. And Professor Nimr, we know that during the first 15 and a half months leading up to the January 19th implementation of the Gaza ceasefire, Yemenis put a ban on, according to Mr. Napier, the strategic waterways. Any Israeli-linked vessel was not allowed to access those waterways, and it nearly 200-plus vessels were commandeered for trying to get goods into occupied ports of Palestine there. And then next to that, the Yemenis also, they engaged with missiles and drone operations against the occupied ports of Palestine, we know, in support of the Palestinian people, and they said that it will stop once the Gaza ceasefire is implemented, and they did. post January 19th, we didn't see any more operations from the Yemenis. So we have to ask, when we know that that Gaza ceasefire was so pressing and its implementation so effective and it brought so much tensions to an end, why did the U.S. allow it to fail?
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, the Yemenis had put a kind of a condition. If you cease fire in Gaza, we will stop our operations against the any vessels who are carrying, whatever goods to Israel military or otherwise through the Red Sea. And they did, because they caused the Israeli really a huge kind of losses, especially when they targeted Eilat port in Rashrash, and also targeted even Tel Aviv with hypersonic rockets. But at the same time, they said if there is a ceasefire and Israel stop this genocide in Gaza, we will stop, because we are supporting the Palestinians, and this is what we are doing. So if you have a ceasefire, we will do it. So when ceasefire goes on, the Yemenis is stopped, and they respected their decision, and they stopped all kind of operations in the Red Sea. And even Israel and the other countries could use the Red Sea and the Arab Sea freely now without any threats. But what happened? Then the Israeli came out and they started this starvation and blocking all the crossings with Gaza, preventing the Palestinians from food, water, oil, and everything which is related to their daily life. And now for more than a month, a Palestinian now really suffering really a hunger problem. So the Yemeni said, if you don't stop, then we will resume, because this is an act of war. And they just threatened. They didn't do anything yet. Yet the United States, they started bombarding Yemen before Yemeni do anything. It's quite clear that the United States, and especially Trump, his policies in the region, definitely is, as Mick said, it's contrary to what he was elected supposedly for, to talk about, peace, and that he want to bring peace into the area, and he preparing that to resume the Abraham Accords, according to him. But at the same time, he's showing, real problems with the Middle East and supporting Israel and supporting what the Israeli wanted. So he start and resume bombarding Yemen again, even before Yemen start any kind of only threat to resume the war. And they gave the Israeli 4 days in order to stop this blocking of aid to enter, and humanitarian aid to enter to Gaza. I believe that the Americans have an idea that they wanted to eliminate the Yemenis from doing anything. And they have the, during Biden administration, it didn't work. The UK and US, both of them, they bombarded Yemen many times, and it didn't work. So Trump thought more power and more, bombardment to Yemen, that will make the problem end. But it's not going to end, and the Yemenis are not going to be defeated.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. McNapier, when Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, said in mid-March he gave Israel an ultimatum, a four-day ultimatum, to lift the siege on Gaza Israel went and allowed the whole ceasefire at that point to go belly up, as you very well know. But Yemen had not resumed its anti-Israel operations yet when, Professor Nimmer's point, and very accurately so, the U.S. started attacking Yemen. So my question to you, the fact that all this could have been avoided if the U.S. would have pushed the Israelis to respect the ceasefire, one, and two, the fact that the Yemenis are dictating terms to the U.S. and Israel, what does that say about the Yemenis themselves?
It says much for the character and the integrity and the confidence, but also the courage and the understanding of the balance of forces by the Yemeni leadership. The Americans aren't used to being talked to like this. They expect everyone around the world to kowtow, to accept their leadership. But you know, I think this is much deeper than a policy. I think that Israel needs to survive in this area as a murderous regime based on the mass killing of Arabs and Muslims. Israel needs to be surrounded by states which are either devastated, like Syria, Libya, Iraq, or clients, supine clients of the empire. Anything else is unacceptable because Israel is extremely vulnerable. We're talking about 6 million Zionist Jews, probably, maybe less, maybe fewer than that, who are prepared to fight, surrounded by 600 million, I think, is one calculation of the number of Arabs. And they can switch on their TV sets and see Arabs being killed because they're Arabs. Muslims around the world can switch on their... They kill Christian Palestinians as well, but they can mainly see Muslims being killed by this Islamophobic regime because they're Palestinian Muslims. How to survive in that area is not easy. You know, if you imagine six people in a room trying to control 600, it's not easy. You have to divide them. You have to make them afraid. You have to terrorize them. It's the same with 7 million and 600 million. So Israel is deeply fragile, and it can only survive in that area as an ethnic cleansing operation by, as I said, devastating those states which refuse to be clients. So I think there's something profound here. Israel wants to continue with the killing, and the price for continuing with the killing is that the Yemenis will come to their aid, and then America has to be called upon to bomb the Yemenis. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that although he huffs and puffs, Netanyahu, when he meets Trump, understands that Trump is the boss. That's clear from recent developments. But it's also clear that the basic idea of Zionism, which sold itself to Britain initially and then to America as an attack dog in the area, a way in which America could avoid becoming entangled because Israel would do the fighting for it. We now see that with the Yemenis coming into the equation, America has to intervene to save Israel, not delegate the role in the whole region of attack dog to Israel. So I think this is a profound crisis, but for the Zionists, we don't know how this will play out inside Israeli society. Saad Nimmer's insights into this would be valuable. But I think America generally tries to solve its problems by great violence, by aircraft carriers, by B-52 bombs, etc., etc. But they seem to have come up against an enemy here, an opponent, which is different from the rest. Because the majority of people in Egypt, of course, support the Palestinians, but the regime is completely different. What you have is a unity between the people in Yemen and the leadership, and that's very dangerous for the Americans and for the Israelis.
And that's the thing, Professor Nimmer, because Abdel Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, he's implored other Arab and regional leaders to stand with Yemen and its operations and its stance against the U.S. and Zionist plots, saying that their plans go far beyond the Palestinian people and Palestine, that they are an existential threat to the region and the nations of the region itself.
Well, yes. Let me just remind you with something. When the Yemenis managed to impose this embargo on the Israeli entity generally and prevent the Red Sea delivery of any kind of commercial ships to come to Israel from that side, Israel suffered a lot. What the Arab did? Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and through Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and to Jordan, there was a line of supplies of food and everything which was missing to go to Israel. So Arabs, instead of standing with the Palestinians, to the contrary, they were solving the problems of Israel, which the Yemenis has imposed. So when Abdul Malik al-Houthi is asking all the other Arabs to do at least, you know, the minimum they should do in this case. If you don't want to stand with the Palestinians and to fight Israel, at least don't help Israel. This is something, you know, unbelievable. So his call for the Arab leaders is really because it's shame for those Arab countries, because as Mick said just a minute ago, they are clients to the Israelis and the American also supremacy over the area. Let me just, you know, say at the same time, we are talking about also Egypt and Qatar. Both countries are now, they are accommodating the talks and the talks between the Israelis and the Americans and the Palestinians in order to have a ceasefire in Gaza. But at the same time, they are applying pressure on Hamas and on the Palestinian resistance rather than applying pressure on Israel. Why they didn't stand up and say, it is Israel who is breaking all these agreements, it's not the Palestinians. But they didn't say that, which is the minimum. You've been there and you've been a mediator and you know exactly what's going on. Why at least you didn't just tell the truth of what happened during these negotiations and who break the agreement and who's committed to the agreement? So it's something sometimes, you know, it makes you think of what kind of Arabs and Muslims we are talking about here. So al-Houthi, when he talk, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, when he asked Arabs and other countries, you know, to help, at least he would put them in front of their responsibilities, which they are not even doing the minimum that they should do.
And thank you there. And Mr. Napier, let's also touch on Yemen's military advance, its evolution of its arsenal there. When the Saudi-led coalition started attacking Yemen back in March of 2015, I believe, Yemen did not have a remarkable drone arsenal. It had pretty crude missiles at the time. Today it has hypersonic missiles reaching Tel Aviv. It has these super-fast frigates all over the Red Sea. It has multiple types of drones, all homegrown, sophisticated, indigenous-built equipment. In 10 years' time, tell us how remarkable the military advancements for Yemen have been.
Well, I'm far from a military expert, but I do know that it was technological advances which almost allowed the Egyptian soldiers in 73 to inflict a devastating defeat on Israel. Instead, they fought to a draw. It was the technological developments which worked against Israel. I think the same is true here today. The distance between Yemen and Israel is significant, but Israel is very vulnerable with its airports and its advanced infrastructure and its nuclear power stations and so on. Israel's very vulnerable to the missiles that can be fired from Yemen. And the Yemenis have a strong hand. They have been fighting against... It was the Saudis who dropped the American bombs by proxy for so many years. Now the Americans are dropping the bombs themselves. But Israel remains very vulnerable to an attack from Yemen. So I think the balance of power is such that I think generally speaking, the Palestinians cannot win their freedom by themselves. Despite the amazing achievements of the Palestinian resistance, they cannot defeat America, the EU, Britain, Canada, etc., ranged against them. This needs to be solved at a regional level. And Israel cannot survive for a year without the active complicity of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other regimes which Saad referred to. Without that complicity, they could not carry on the way they are doing. So the genocide can only be carried out with the connivance and the active complicity, as Saad points out. The Yemenis asked permission, I think, a couple of years ago. Would the Saudis allow the Yemenis to march to fight the Israelis? That's all they needed to do, open the borders and let them go to fight. But the Saudis actually actively cooperate with the Israelis against the resistance. That's the sad truth. And until that situation has changed, the Palestinians will always remain in great peril from this genocidal and regime and its local backers.
Thank you, Mr. McNapier. And Professor Nimmer, final question to you. We know Donald Trump has threatened Yemen with this hell on earth to pay if they don't stop attacking Israel and Israeli-linked vessels. He really likes that one. He said Hamas in Gaza, hell on earth, hell to pay. Iran, hell to pay, hell on earth. Yemen, hell on earth. But you remember when you mentioned a fire and fury with North Korea in his first term, that got the attention of the North Koreans. Kim Jong-un met with them a couple times. They sat down, they spoke. But the Yemenis seem very unfazed with the U.S. president's threats. Why?
Well, apparently Trump, first of all, he liked this word, you know, hell on earth, and he used it frequently. But at the same time, there is something he missed, that there are, you know, lots of changes had happened to the region and to the world before, you know, like, you know, I'm not talking about the 60s and the 70s, when he could send his troops over any country and defeat this country. Now the whole game is changed, and the way it changed. And after the 7th of October, we have witnessed now something is regional is being changed as well, when Hezbollah and Ansar Allah in Yemen also participated in this war. So he's threatening, but at the same time, he couldn't do anything to Yemen. Sorry. Threatening Gaza with hell after 15 months of genocide. What he would do more? And Yemen, after 8 years of war, which was supported by American, by the way, what kind of things that he could do more to the Yemenis more than 8 years? So the Yemenis, they do know exactly what the Americans are able to do, and at the same time, they can resist them and they can fight back. At the same time, Yemenis are insisting he didn't know even the psychology of the Yemenis and the culture of the Yemenis. And this is something, it's far away from the mind of Trump. He thought that he can threaten anyone and they should comply immediately after his threat. This is something he had to learn, that this is has changed. Neither Hamas or the Houthis will change their mind.
Great input and contributions to the program. Thank you both, and appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to both of you. Professor Saad Nimmer, they're joining us out of Ramallah, and Mr. McNapier, they're joining us out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. That brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illa.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim and Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Ahmad Danish is over here to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
Okay, Sheikh Ahmad Danish, in a beautiful prophetic hadith, we read that Kalimatul Hikmah Zalatul Mu'min. The words of wisdom are the lost, we can say, desires of a believer. In fact, a believer is in pursuit of, or must be in pursuit of, we can say the words of wisdom or wisdom anywhere he finds. So, first of all, give us the full text of the hadith by Prophet Muhammad, and then define for us kalimat al-hikmah. I mean, what does it mean by the words of wisdom?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for the topic and introducing it. As you know, that the full text of the hadith says in Biharul Anwar, I'm quoting from Biharul Anwar, it says that Kalimatul Hikmah Dallatul Mumin. فَحَيْسُ وَجَدَهَا فَهُوَ أَحَقُّ بِهَا. That is, the words of wisdom are something that a believer has lost. So wherever you find something that you have lost, haisu wajadaha fahuwa ahakko biha. So he is more worthy of it, right? So for example, what happens if a person has lost his baggage at the airport, right? Sometimes it happens that a flight comes and your baggage is left behind in a transit flight.
All right.
Right. So what will happen? That whenever that lost baggage comes, the airline will call you and tell you that your baggage has been found and you can come and take it mm-hmm. from us.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same manner, the hadith is telling us that wherever words of wisdom are found,
mm-hmm.
a believer is worthy of having those or applying those words of wisdom in his life. Because a believer's life is a life of reason, a life based on tawheed, a life based on wilaya, and application of the realities of the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in their material and their spiritual lives.
That's right.
So wherever words of wisdom are found, these are in sync with the realities of the world. And these are in sync with the realities of this material world and the higher spiritual world.
That's right.
So whatever is found by the mu'min in other traditions, for example, these should be incorporated in the life of a mu'min, or because this is something that is worthy of the life of a believer.
So these words of wisdom can be from the side of the non-Muslims or even, I don't know, maybe disbelievers? Is it so?
Even. The hadith doesn't say that these are specifically from a religious tradition. For example, what happens if we find some words of wisdom in the Old Testament and the New Testament,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of the stories about the prophets that have not been mentioned in the Holy Quran.
All right.
So we have to identify, but of course this is a work of trained scholars.
Yes.
That they identify that which are the stories that are truly words of wisdom.
Okay.
Because we know that these books have been distorted as well.
Yes.
So it is the work of experts who are trained in these sciences to find out these words of wisdom in all of the different sciences, in history books, in different traditions and cultures, and to bring it for the benefit of the Muslims
mm-hmm.
And the Muslim community.
Yes, that's right. Okay. And the words of wisdom, you know, we know that there is a part in Nahj al-Balagha, compiled by Sayyid al-Razi, I mean, as the words of wisdom. So the words of wisdom are to be defined in what way and based on what standard, Sheikh? Is it only referring to religious matters, non-religious matters, the point about our daily life, or what?
For example, we can see in some of the social sciences, right?
Yes.
So in this day and age, we had from the past 100 or 150 years back, this concept of social sciences came about. And we had numerous social sciences. We had psychology, we had sociology, anthropology, economics.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these sciences are trying to understand, for example, human activity and human life from different aspects. So if we study, for example, psychology, we come across this concept of three layers to a person's existence. The conscious existence, the subconscious existence, and the unconscious world of a human being. And the picture of the unconscious is like an iceberg. That is, an iceberg, only a very small part of it is on the surface. And what is beneath the surface is the most of the iceberg is beneath the surface.
All right.
And so the subconscious or the unconscious world of a person is introduced in with this metaphor.
Okay.
And so this is a concept in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that this applies also in our lives as well. We can, when we come across this concept, we see that this same concept can explain a lot of things in our life as well, because our subconscious and the unconscious mind controls a lot of what we do consciously in our day-to-day lives. And so some of these things you can say that are tested over time. They become hikmah. Why? Because human beings over a period of time follow the predictions of these theories, for example. We can test these theories over time, and they are found to be true by a lot of the experts. And so therefore, this can give insights into our own existence and the existence of others. And we can apply it in a way that it doesn't negate our religious beliefs. And so there's no reason not to accept such opinions and theories.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this is the work of experts who are trained in these sciences and who are trained in matters of religion and who can guide us as to which of these beliefs and wisdoms
That's
we
right.
need to incorporate in our daily lives.
Okay. Thank you very much,